Today is August 6th, which is one of the most important of the high Holy Orthodox religious days. It's the Feast of the Transfiguration. The Gospel account tells of Christ ascending the Mount with three of his disciples, and they witness his face and body, even clothes, becoming transfigured into light. The whole world is transfigured at that moment, that the divine is here. It's not elsewhere, but it's here. So the transfiguration is today. Also, 59 years ago today was the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We can refer to this as a disfiguration of the world. And we live between those two. And deliberately choosing which way we go is the work. Second to last day, as Dave and I have learned to recognize at this point, if you're the kind of person who hangs back, this is a good time to enter, second to last day. The danger at this point is tiredness. And it's not tiredness just in itself, it's the indifference and the impatience that arises from tiredness. Usually what tires us is meaninglessness. Here, it's a superabundance of meaning that brings about a quality of exhaustion. The work then is to deepen the meaning, not to let it just spin as merely verbal possibility. And there's an Eastern Orthodox practice I want to make reference to at this point. It's the phrase, bring the mind down into the heart. This is an exact and very practical practice. This is not mindlessness. It's the increasing of intelligence by planting the intelligence directly in the heart. There's an Orthodox teaching, the same way that God himself came down on the world, became actually incarnate here. So the mind goes down into the heart and incarnates there. A dozen times an hour, a dozen times a minute, we remember the heart and bringing the mind into that heart. At the start of the week, we needed sympathy. This point, we need something deeper. It's a quality of forgiveness. Forgiveness for our own failed attempts in the art, and forgiveness for one another. And the great work can open. And it's a great pleasure to welcome today one of our very brightest and loveliest of poets and a beautiful person, Ellen Bryan Voigt.
As it is, there are a few mosquitoes kind of flying around up there. So how long a leash do I have, Danny, from this? Okay. All right. Does everybody have the handouts now? Did they make their way around? You should have three pages. You're missing one. We're missing two. Okay. Well, let's do it this way. Who's missing the page of prose? There's a page of prose. So we need 1, 2, 3, 4, or can people share and maybe pass one or two of those back? Would that be okay? Yeah, there's the prose page. Are there any people who would share and pass to the back the page of prose? Yeah. Raise your hands if you need a page of prose. Page of prose back here. Anybody else? Page of prose? Okay. Another one back? Prose page. Everybody's got a prose page now? Can see one? Okay, the other two things you have, you have two poems. One is a poem by Donald Justice called Psalm and Lament. Who is missing that? Who is missing Donald Justice? Okay. Again, are there people who can share, look on? We pass those back. I think it's the back row that needs them. Anybody willing to give that up? Thank you. Couple more. Couple more. Does that do it now? Is anyone now who cannot see a copy of that poem? And then the third handout is Rethke and the Meta Mouse. Who's missing the Meta Mouse? Okay, people in the back. Again, sharers. A few more of those. Meta Mouse. Just one? Can we have one to the back? Okay. So now everybody can see Meta Mouse. So we're set. Okay. All right. What I want to talk about today is syntax, which is something that I've been thinking about pretty hard for about the past 7 or 8 years. And I want to preface it by telling you an assumption that I'll be using. And that assumption has to do with the difference between form and structure, which was something I thought about for about 20 years, mainly trying to figure out the difference. When I had not been writing very long, someone very smart said to me one time, oh, I've never seen anybody who had such a high sense of form and no sense of structure whatsoever. And at the time, I thought that everybody in the world knew the difference between those two, except for me. And so I didn't come forward and say, well, what do you mean by that, and what is the difference? I should have. It would have saved me a lot of time. But I just figured that I would learn that, because everyone else clearly knew the difference. And as I began to try to research that, I found out that, in fact, no, that not everyone clearly did know the difference or even assumed that there was a difference, in part because of the influence of the new critics in this country. The new critics were very fond of form and formal arrangement, and therefore gave it a higher priority over everything else. And starting with understanding poetry and moving then through Cleanthes Brooks and The Well-Wrought Urn and a number of other very influential volumes of criticism, pretty soon the terms became interchangeable one with another. And in fact, if you look up in Understanding Poetry and you look up the definition of form and you look up the definition of structure, it says the same thing. And I didn't find that helpful. So what I came to decide, I'm not going to talk about that today because I've written about it. It's the title essay in The Flexible Lyric is about that. But I did want to at least come forward and tell you my assumptions about it. My assumptions about it are that form in poetry is the same as form in any other art, which is to say that it controls exclusion and inclusion, and that it is built on pattern and variation. All pattern and what you have is dead. You don't have art. All variation and what you have is chaos. You don't have art. And so it's form, and the form of any given art is particular to that art. And I find that I can distinguish, if I work real hard at it, I can distinguish between that in a poem and structure, which is what holds the house up. And essentially, you can think of structure as existing or having a relationship with time that form does not. In fact, for form, time is really the enemy. And what form is trying to do is to stop time or to stop that inexorable movement of time. Structure exists in time, particularly in poetry, because poetry is made of language, and language is released to us discursively. That is, one thing at a time. Okay, so you can think of structure then as the order in which information is released to the reader. The order in which information is released to the reader. Why does the first stanza come first instead of last? Why does the last stanza come last? That has to do with what you are releasing when. Okay, so those are my assumptions. And in thinking about this, I started trying to break that down even further because, of course, in the greatest poems, the most memorable poems, form and structure are happening at the same time, and very often some of the same elements are working to make a contribution both to form and to structure, so it gets pretty hard to sort those things out and to say, well, now, wait a minute, which is which? If you look at a Shakespeare sonnet, if you look at that time of year, they're made in me, behold. What you find is three quatrains that are made exactly the same way. Exactly the same way. And each is a figure. Each is a metaphor. The structural question is, why do they come in the order that they come? Well, they come in a kind of progression. He starts with the largest of them, which is the season. And then he moves to a smaller one, which is the day, dying out. And then he moves to the fire, which is even shorter. Okay, so that there's a progression. Instead of starting with the fire and then going to the season and then coming back to the day, right? It would still maintain all of its formal properties if he had done that. But by having progression, then he has a kind of movement. He has something vital that happens in the structure. Oh, okay, as I began to think about this and try to figure out ways to break this down even further, it seemed to me that the unit to pay attention to would be the sentence, because the sentence works the same way. A sentence is a structure, and it presents information in a particular order. Once upon a time, in a galaxy far, far away, there were two contending theories about how we acquire language. One was developed by Mr. Piaget, who felt that basically a child is a tabula rasa, right? It's a clean slate, and everything must be written there. So everything in regard to language, the words that we use and the order that we use them in, would have to be learned by the child. And then there was another guy, and the other guy said, no, it's really not like that. We are hardwired for language. And we are hardwired for syntax. Syntax meaning merely the order in which words appear in the sentence. Well, it turns out that both were right. Now that they have MRIs and they have all of this elaborate equipment to really peer into the brain, they can see what happens in the brain when we respond to language or use language. And what they find is that what we think of as the territory of language, we think about left brain, right brain, right, which is an old paradigm that is no longer true. We don't really have our brains divided in half. We have, in fact, little modules all around the brain that are responsible for particular tasks. And sometimes we have more than one module for any given task. Over here, right above the left ear, is what's called Broca's area, and that's where you put all of your lexicon, all of the words that you learn, and you have to learn them. Piaget was right about that. You learn them. You learn them by exposure, and you store them mainly right over here, although not all in exactly the same place. You have a little part of Broca's area that takes care of nouns. And you have another little part of Broca's area that takes care of verbs. And you have another one that's in charge of adjectives. And you have another one that's in charge of adverbs. And it's not the only place where they are. When my son was 9 years old, his best friend had a cerebral hemorrhage. He's perfectly fine now. I want you to know he's 28 years old and a strappy young man, and he's fine. But at the time, it was pretty dangerous, and he had to have fairly extensive surgery to repair where two blood vessels were supposed to come together, and they didn't. They just sort of went off disconnected. So when they did the brain surgery, they had to wipe out a large part of the brain tissue that was just above the left ear. And what they wiped out was nouns. And the surgeons warned his parents about this and said, now, you know, when he comes out of the anesthesia, he may not be able to recover nouns. But that's all right. If you can, resist just teaching him again. That's a slow way. That's the Piaget way. That's the slow way. Resist that and see if he can locate some of those words in some other part of the brain. So sure enough, he woke up from the surgery. And he asked his mother for some of that cold, sweet stuff. He could describe it, but he didn't have the word for ice cream, couldn't find it anymore. So a couple of weeks after that, my friend was driving David to some after-school event and handed him a snack in the car, and it was a banana. So he took the banana and, as was their little game, tried to figure out what to call it. And I said, wow, it's this curvy thing, this slick thing, this yellow curvy slick thing. And she said, yeah, what's its name? So he turned the banana over, and he noticed this little sticker on the side And he thought, aha, that's what it is. So he was trying to read the sticker, and he said, oh, I know what it is. It's a cha, it's a cha, it's a cha. She said, yeah, that's right, Chiquita. And he said, I'm Chiquita Banana, and I'm here to say, eat a banana every day. That was in the module, you see, that was over here, that had to do with song. And in fact, what they have found out with the, you know, the MRIs and the studies that they do, is they have found out that syntax, the sentences we make, that doesn't happen anywhere near Broca's area. It's over in this part, sort of slightly to what we used to call the right brain, and very close to all of the areas that control for music. Chomsky said that for every language, there is a deep structure. In other words, something that it requires and forms its essential element. And then out of that deep structure, we develop what's called a transformational grammar, which is to say variations on that, variations on whatever that deep structure might be. And that we come into the world hardwired to do this. We come with a module that's already very eager to pay attention to how words work together, because it's only when they work together that we make meaning. Okay? You know that, because you can look up any word in the dictionary and it'll have, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 definitions, some of which are directly contradictory to one another, right? So how do you know whether ravel is to stitch up or ravel is to unstitch? You know about that because of the context that's made out of the sentence. So the sentence is the unit of meaning. That's how we make meaning, right? And what happens with the child is that very quickly, they say within about 18 months, your capacity to learn any language in the world begins to shut off. And it begins to, your brain begins to ignore all these other possible deep structures and to focus on the one that will be your primary language. That's what we mean by the mother tongue, right? And whatever it is. Okay, so if it's a language, for instance, that doesn't use articles, you let go of that capacity to think about the and and. And sometimes if you meet someone whose mother language was Russian, for instance, they just kind of drop those articles, right? Because they don't really register there. So in the child's brain, then, the main part of the deep structure of the given language, what's called the fundament, begins to take over and to control that area that has to do with syntax, which is a song. Okay? It is a song. In English, the fundament is the subject and the verb. That's the fundament. And the brain gets used to all kinds of little dramas about how soon that's going to be released. And we have no problem with that, because what we do when we're processing sentences, what you're doing right now as you're listening to me, is a thing that the neurolinguists call chunking. You'll hear a little signal that'll say, okay, prepositional phrase coming up. You hear in, of, over, above, and it's a little signal to your brain that says prepositional phrase coming up. Okay, in the tree, across the yard, down the road. Fine, fine, fine. We're waiting, we're waiting, we're waiting, right? No fundament yet. You don't confuse that. You don't go, oh, is in the subject? Is, you know, is tree the verb? No, you know perfectly well what it is. Okay, so that then becomes a little rhythmic phrase, that little chunk, and it works on you exactly the way music does, exactly the way music does. And that's why when they look at pathology, sometimes people who have strokes, if they lose the ability to make a sentence, then they also lose the ability very often to recognize music, which is to say to recognize the patterns in it. They cannot hear the patterns in it anymore. Okay? Or you can retain that and retain that song and lose all of the words, so that then you can make a perfectly coherent sounding sentence, except that it doesn't make any sense because it's, you know, it's not in the tree. It's, you know, it's something that doesn't quite add up. Okay? It seems to me that as poets, we have an unusually high appetite for form, that we think about that more, we worry about it more, and we may be drawn to poetry because it is more overt and because there are more occasions for it. And sometimes perhaps you, as I have done, forget that we are also writing in English sentences. And so we don't pay any attention to syntax. And yet, syntax is another rhythmic system. In poetry, we have two. It's like playing the organ. You have to have, you have what your hands are doing, and you also have what your feet are doing. And I think that that's part of why we love it, because of that dual opportunity, the two rhythmic systems, whereas the poor people writing in prose only have one. All they've got is the sentence, right? But we've got two. And the two that we have, first of all, we have the one that is given, that is part of the language, right? This is the thing that you've been learning since you were, you know, 6 months old. This is the module that you were hardwired for. And that you have now, as adults, you have millions and millions and millions of surface structures, is what Chomsky called them, which are just variations on the fundament, how, you know, where the fundament comes in relation to all the other words. Your reader also has that too. Your reader has that too. So it seems to me that if we don't pay attention to the sentences we're writing in, we are missing a huge opportunity. Meanwhile, I think that we are paying attention to the line, because the line is very confusing, and especially very confusing in this era of open form or free verse. The line is always artifice, and that's why we love it. The line does not exist anywhere. It doesn't exist in the language. It doesn't exist in the natural world. It doesn't exist anywhere. It only exists in your ear. And whether you choose to make a metrical line or whether you choose to write in free verse, every single time you are the bird on the bush saying, me, 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 my sound, my sound, my sound. And you're putting that against this other system which exists in the language. Now, you can put it against it in a very violent way so that it struggles with it, or you can put it in what I call a consonant way where they go hand in hand. And this has always been the case with the making of poetry in English. Always, always, always the relationship between those two rhythmic systems, the line and the sentence. Okay? Now, all of that is warm-up. All of that is sort of background to say what I want to do with you is I want to look at syntax in two poems. And I want to talk about syntax as the smallest unit of organization in structure, okay? Because I know that you'll go immediately to formal matters. That's where your appetite is. And where I want to start is with a piece of prose.
Okay. I missed the key word.
I'm not sure what I said. What was it about? Pardon me? Yeah, I want to look at it as that. And I'm not about to claim that that is the case. There might be something smaller than that. Yeah. Yes. Variation. Pattern and variation. Do-do-do-do. Do-do-do-do. There's a pattern. There's the variation. It's true for any art. You know, if you look at a painting or you look at those photographs over there, if you have a large rectangle, I see in that one, I can see that from here even with my bad eyes, then where does that also duplicate itself? Then you can see, down underneath, there's another little rectangle that is occluded. And then over here on the side, there's a little rectangle. And then there's this other thing that may be a hexagon, or there's something in the wallpaper there up on the side that is a variation on that. And the relation, then, of those parts. Why is it cropped where it is cropped? It may be cropped where it is cropped because right over to the left would be a huge circle. And then that would blow the photograph out of the water. Okay, so whatever the art is, I mean, the same is true for dance, for sculpture, for music, certainly. Pattern and variation, okay? That's form, and that's the formal appetite that we have, that we want to supply it or uncover it, however you want to, you know, think about that. And that's what we try to do in our poems. That's also, I think, what one tries to do in all the literary arts. And what I wanted to show you was just a paragraph. This is from the opening of a story, wonderful story by Maeve Brennan. This is on the page of prose, right? The priest Christ's mother was distracted with herself, wakeful, impenitent, heated in every part by a wearisome discontent that had begun in her spirit very young. She wore herself out cleaning her house, going over her rooms with her dry, violent hands, scraping and plucking and picking and rubbing the walls and floors and furniture, and stopping in the middle to clench her fingers, tight, 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 but not tight enough, never enough for her. There was no tightness, hard and fast enough to satisfy her. Therefore, she continued in want. Okay, this is the opening paragraph of this story. The first thing, really, I'd like for you to notice is the difference in the length of the sentences. There are only three sentences here, right? The first one is a kind of medium length, and the last one is very short, and then the longest one is right in the middle, okay? That is a formal construction because it swells out in the middle, and then it comes back to something even smaller than where it began, okay? How does Mae Brennan accomplish this? Well, she does it in a fairly straightforward way. Because the fundament in English is the subject and the verb, then the sentence structure that will be most useful for clarity is what's called normal order, which is to say, put it first. Just put it right up there first. The brain goes, ah, there it is. And then what follows, we usually have there two primary kinds of drama in a sentence. One is to use parallelism. You remember this from eighth grade, right? So that you have what follows then would be repetitions of the same grammatical function. Repetitions of the same grammatical function. That would be parallelism. Or the other one is what the neurolinguists call a right branching. They have in mind a tree. It's, you know, I never have liked that figure very much because it looks like the tree is about to fall down. But it means that I think of it as a mobile. If you have the fundament up there, the subject and the verb, then you can hang things on them. Right? And you can hang things asymmetrically. Asymmetrically. It doesn't have to be exactly symmetrical all the way through. Okay? So that's right branching. Okay? Those are the two big ways to do it. Okay, in this first sentence, the priest's mother, and there's your subject, was distracted, and there's the predicate. So we have the fundament right up at the beginning, with herself. That's a modifying little prepositional phrase, right? And it's just tacked on. It's not, we don't get confused. We don't say, you know, what's happening? We say, oh, yeah, okay, this belongs to the distracted. Then we have these three little modifiers, wakeful, impenitent, heated. Wakeful, impenitent, heated. That's parallelism, right? There are three modifiers. But what I want you to see is they're not all the same musically. Wakeful, impenitent, heated in every part by a wearisome discontent that had begun in her spirit very young. Do you hear that? So we've got like these three things on the crib toy, and they're exactly the same thing. They're modifiers, right? We know where they're hanging, and our brain knows what they are. We're going, ah, yeah, okay, parallelism, wakeful, yeah, fine. Impenitent, fine. And then we get this big one, heated in every part by a wearisome discontent that had begun in her spirit very young. This is satisfying to us because you're going to have pattern in the function of the grammar and you'll have variation in the length of the musical phrase. This is just a gorgeous sentence. That's that third little crib toy, too. See how that is made. That's right branching off of itself, right? Heated. Heated how? Heated in every part. Heated how? Heated by a discontent. What kind of discontent? Wearisome. What other kind of discontent? The discontent that had begun in her spirit very young. That's a whole clause, right? But we're not confused. We don't think, oh, maybe that's really the subject of the sentence. No, because that has been our little marker. Signal the brain. The brain goes, oh, yeah, we're still talking about the discontent. No problem. Okay? Order in which information is released to the reader. What if she had made this sentence by saying, starting it, wakeful, impenitent, heated in every part by a wearisome discontent that had begun in her spirit very young, the priest's mother was distracted with herself. You hear how different that is? Right? Okay? We can still parse it. We can still figure it out. Right? But the satisfaction of getting that the fundament right up first, then getting the parallelism in the grammar, and then having that extended, that right branching into something long. You hear how the sentence just absolutely opens up. What does it open up to? Had begun in her spirit very young, ends that sentence, and so then that becomes the thing I hang on to when I go to the next fundament. She wore herself out. She wore herself out. You see? If we'd done it the other way and ended that sentence on the priest's mother was distracted with herself, she wore herself out, that has a different meaning, right? So, again, the formal pleasure of making that shape, and at the same time, the sentence is a structure in terms of ordering the information that is released to the reader. Okay, look at that second one. She wore herself out. She wore herself out how? She wore, we got the fundament again, right up front. Absolutely clear. We know the subject. We know the verb, right? No problem. What comes under that? Cleaning, going over, scraping, plucking, picking, rubbing, stopping. Well, that's parallelism, right? Those are all participles, and they all line up right there together. They have the same grammatical function. Your brain knows that. Your brain is not at all confused. You go, oh, yeah, there she is, and she's doing all of these things. But again, look at the asymmetry in each one of those. Scraping and plucking and picking and rubbing the walls and floors and furniture. That one gets objects. So once again, you have pattern because it's the same grammatical function, but you have variation because of the length of that musical phrase. Okay? So this whole little, I think that this is absolutely brilliant. She wore herself out cleaning her house, going over her rooms with her dry violin hands, scraping and plucking and picking and rubbing the walls and floors and furniture. There's no way to predict that, right? There's no way to know where that sentence is going to go. And so it enacts a little drama. It's a little drama, what's going to happen next. And that is what creates energy. It keeps the sentence vital and alive, as opposed to giving us a list where each one of those phrases happened to be exactly the same length, exactly the same shape. She wore herself out, cleaning her house, going over her rooms with her dry violin hands, scraping and plucking and picking and rubbing the walls and floors and furniture, and stopping in the middle to clench her fingers. That's that right branching. You hear it? The other way you can think about it is you can think about a train. And if you think of the fundament being the engine, and it's pulling along behind itself these boxcars, right? And the boxcars, some might not have very much in them, and some may be heaped up, okay? So that you get this other thing that's sort of passing in time. It's discursive, one thing right after another. She wore herself out, cleaning her house, going over her rooms with her dry violin hands, scraping and plucking and picking and rubbing the walls and floors and furniture, and stopping in the middle to clench her fingers tight, 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 but not tight enough, never enough for her. There was no tightness hard and fast enough to satisfy her. It's just taking us somewhere else. And off we go, and the whole paragraph opens up, and then what? Then what does Maeve Brennan do? Maeve Brennan always, in her paragraphs, brings us back to some place where we started. Therefore, she continued in want. Nails it down. End of paragraph. Therefore, she continued in want. Okay? So just that difference in the length of the sentence, in the length of the little units within the sentence, shouldn't poets be paying attention to that? That's music. That's rhythm. And shouldn't that matter to us as much as where we put a line break? What are we breaking anyway? I think by that we mean we're breaking the syntax. Is that what we mean? But we might want to think about what it is that we're putting this artificial thing against. Okay. And if you do nothing else, if you don't, you know, register anything else that I say this morning, you go back to your poems, cast them out as prose, and look at them and see if the sentences are exactly the same in length, if perhaps they're all simple declarative, if they all, you know, put the fundament up at the very beginning, then you have foregone an opportunity for tremendous management of rhythm and energy and where you want to end up, order in which information is released to the reader. I'll just read you one more paragraph and then we'll look at the poems. She does this over and over. I recommend this book to you very highly. Mrs. Durden had the face of a woman who had a good deal to put up with. Mrs. Durden had, there it is, she always does that. She always gives, you know, that sort of normal order so that we get first, you know, the subject and the verb. And then that one is right branching off, right? Who had a good deal to put up with as a subordinate clause? At this moment, she was in the kitchen putting up with getting the tea ready for herself and her husband. Nice little play, isn't it? Because your brain goes, oh, putting, getting. But those are different grammatical functions, right? Because one is a participle and one is a gerund. But so we hear that pattern and variation at exactly the same time. Her husband's name was Hubert. I think that's funny. Isn't that funny? And it's funny because those first three sentences are made exactly like the other three sentences, right? So we have a kind of mid-length sentence, and then we have a longer sentence, and then this very short sentence. Her husband's name was Hubert. She was putting up with. Oh, so we got to go back to that. We'll pick it up. She was putting up with setting out the two cups and the two plates and the two saucers and so on, two of everything. Huh? That's a musical extension. She could have just said she was putting up with setting out two of everything, right? She didn't have to name every time, repeat the two. But we like that. That's pattern, right? We love pattern. And so this is a great pleasure. And again, it extends the sentence. There was no need now to set the table for more than two people. The third place was empty, and the third face was missing. That is a brilliant sentence, because all of the other sentences have had fundament, right branching, fundament, right branching. This is a different thing. This different thing is exactly even. This is a compound. This and they're put together. Parataxis. They're exactly the same. Parataxis. There was no need now to set the table for more than two people. Okay, another one of our right branching. The third place was empty and the third face was missing. Do you hear you don't really need the two parts of the sentence for information, do you? I mean, wouldn't it work? I can see the workshop now, right? The workshop says, oh, you could just say the third place was empty. Period, stop, right? Or you could just say the third face was missing. I mean, this is not providing new information. Yes, it is, because the information is emotive, because it's coming out of the song of it. And this is, again, it's a different kind of sentence. John, her son, had left the house, and he would not be back. That's at compound again, and this one's going to be right branching, because he had vanished forever into the commonest crevasse in Irish family life, the priesthood. Longest sentence, right? Longest sentence. You hear that? Now, does she end the paragraph there? The workshop would say, oh, stop there. Mm-mm. It gives us perfectly useless information. John had gone away to become a priest. Hey, didn't you just say that, Maeve? Didn't you say he'd vanish forever into the priesthood? I know that he's going to become a priest. So why is that sentence there? Let's cut that sentence out. No, let's not cut that sentence out, because, once again, like that other paragraph, it brings us back to something short and declarative. Okay, so there's a shape, there's a movement, there's a little song that's happening in the paragraph. And this, poor Mae Brennan doesn't have lineation. All she's got is the sentences. All right? Para, as in paralegal. It means equal to or side by side. So basically, parataxis, the strictest definition is when you have two clauses. Okay, two independent clauses. Both are of equal importance. You can also think of parataxis, and we'll see this in the Donald Justice poem, as other efforts or other devices that would allow you to put out units of syntax that are exactly the same. And the opposite of that is hypotaxis. Hypotaxis means one thing has dominance over the other. It is a power relationship. So there is an independent clause, and then there is a dependent clause, like the who clause. That's one. Or the because. It's less important than the fundament. Okay, so that's hypotaxis. Puts things in relation to one another. Yeah.
You talk about how powerful it is to have a sentence where the fundament is first.
No, I wouldn't say powerful. I would say that it is the way to do it for the greatest clarity of semantic meaning.
What I was wondering was, I'm sure that even more music can come from sort of varying between ones that put it first and then others that sort of relate upon it.
Absolutely. Or, there's the opening sentence in The Moose that goes on for how many tercets? That's a periodic sentence. And so there's something like 16 or 17 tercets before you ever get to that bus. So, no, I wouldn't say that it's the most powerful. I would say that in terms of discursive meaning, you tax the brain less because you put it out there. And this is why all the primers are made that way, right? Sally runs. Spot leaps. Or whatever. Spot leaps over the log. So that it right branches out. So if you're looking for discursive clarity, that's the way to do it. If you're writing, let's say, a long narrative poem, if you're D.H. Lawrence and you're writing The Snake and you want all those movements of the snake, it's very useful to you to put the fundament up first and then let it go wherever it's going to go. But I wouldn't say the most powerful. Okay, in fact, why don't I let your question take us to the Rethke poem? And I'll do that one next. We have till 11:30, is that right, Don? Okay. The Meta Mouse. In a shoebox stuffed in an old nylon stocking sleeps the baby mouse. Now, here's one. We don't have it first. And not only that, we don't have it in so-called normal order, right? This is this big no-no. This is an inversion of the normal order, right? Because the subject is, what's the subject of the sentence? Baby mouse, what's the verb? Sleeps. So he puts the sleeps first. Why would he do that? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I want you to think about structure. I want you to think about the order in which information is released to the reader. What if we turned it around? In a shoebox stuffed in an old nylon stocking, the baby mouse I found in the meadow sleeps. Do we like that? The baby mouse I found in the meadow sleeps in a shoebox stuffed in an old nylon stocking. That would be the normal order right branching. Okay, where am I at the end of that sentence? So I'm in the stocking, and where's the stocking? In the shoebox, where's the shoebox? It's not in the meadow. It's not in the meadow at all. It's not in the meadow. No. So I'm in trouble. If either I have to stay inside now, I've got this mouse inside, and I had that one little opportunity, I found it in the meadow, and that's all I can do with meadow. How am I going to get back to meadow? I could just start up another sentence. While I was out in the meadow, I mean, how boring is that? See? So look at what he does with a sentence in order to take us where he needs to take us, in a shoebox stuffed in an old nylon stocking. Present moment, here, shoebox, think shoebox. Sleeps the baby mouse I found in the meadow, where? That's subordinate, right? Where? This is not, we know, we got the mouse, and mouse is asleep. So as soon as we go where, we're making a move in space, no longer where the shoebox is, and I'm also making a move in time, right? Because it couldn't be both places. Couldn't be in the meadow and in the shoebox. So he's putting us back. But the back story is subordinate in the syntax. It's subordinate in the syntax. It's not the main thing. Your brain knows that. Your brain has got that mouse sleeping in the shoebox. Hold it right there. Hold it right there. And now let me tell you all about how it got here. Where he trembled and shook beneath a stick till I caught him by the tail and brought him in. Hey, there's a little narrative move, right? That's several little points in time out there in this other place in the meadow. And the sentence, the structure of the sentence, has made that possible, right? We're not confused. We know where we are. And we get backstory without backstory overwhelming the poem.